Evening, everybody. I'm Mark Houston. I'm an alcoholic. And I was sobered up on October the 19th of 1982, and I'm grateful to God and the program of Alcoholics Anonymous that I have remained that way. The universe is a better place. We'll start off with a little humor this evening before I get into the fourth step, which I also find extremely humorous. Those of you who have much experience with inventory, I hope, are the same way. How many people are here that have a year or less sobriety? Raise your hands. Okay. I'm going to pray that you all have sponsors, and I suspect somewhere in the middle of that, your sponsors have probably talked to you about relationships. And we kind of have a thing in AA. It's suggested first year you might not get in one. I suggest that. A friend of mine said to me one time, we don't know if that works because no one's ever done it, but it's a great idea. But you know how that goes. But at any rate, I sponsor some men, and I can always tell. I normally sponsor chronic relapsers, and I'm sponsoring a couple of men. They're just coming up somewhere between 8 and 12 months, and I normally meet with the people I work with about every 2 weeks or so, but this one guy I hadn't heard from for 3 weeks. And when I work with people, I work with them the same way that I was work with, which is you're responsible for your sobriety. I'm not going to chase you down. I've got a day planner. We'll schedule appointments. So I hadn't heard from this guy. And I made an assumption, which turned out to be true, which is that he had met her. You know how that is if you work with people. They disappear real quick. So at any rate, he finally calls me up, and we get to talking, and I kind of used the big book on him a little. I said, tell me about her. You know, is she in the program? Well, no, she doesn't have the disease. She's a teacher, and he's a teacher, too. And I said, the big book says that, you know, rigorous honesty, right? And he goes, yeah. I said, well, how many times have you gone out? And he said, well, a couple times. And I said, okay. I said, does she know you're an alcoholic? You know, he said, well, kind of. I said, well, you know, if it demands rigorous honesty, how can she make any decision about being in a relationship with you if you don't tell her? And I said, don't you think that's important? I mean, aren't you being dishonest by omission? And see, I'm tricking you. I'm taking him down this little path, right? He goes, yeah, I think you're probably, it's probably right. And I said, so what you need to do when you get with her next time is explain why you're an alcoholic, because he knows why. He takes a drink, he breaks out in a phenomenon called craving, he loses control. And when he's sober at certain times, he goes into a strange mental blank spot, and he goes out and drinks, and he has no choice in that, and so he never knows when that's going to happen on his own power. He said, well, I don't know if I want to tell her that. She'd be rolling dice with me. I said, well, I understand that, but we can't stay sober unless we're honest. You know, he said, well, all right, I'll do that. And I said, well, there's one other thing, though, that you need to tell her. He said, what's that? And I said, I want you to get out a piece of paper and I want you to write this down. Because I said, this way she gets to make an honest evaluation as to whether or not she wants to have a relationship with you. So all of you with 1 year or less, or all of you who haven't done any work with the steps in a long time and your ego's come back, this is what you can say to anyone that's interested in a relationship with you. And this all comes either from the 12 and 12 or from the big book. So this is what I had him write down that I suggested that he tell this woman. So here's what it is. Although I look like a full-grown adult, I am childish, grandiose, and gravely emotionally immature. My natural state is growing anxiety, depression, and fear coupled with an intense desire for excitement. This condition is fueled by an obsessive, compulsive, controlling need for attention, acceptance, and unqualified approval. This renders me restless, irritable, and discontent with life. I'm also maladjusted to life in full flight from reality, and I'm an outright mental defective. This is going to affect my mental and emotional nature and my relationship with you. Mentally, my thought life is governed by 100 forms of fear, self-delusion, self-seeking, self-pity, all of which drive me to live my life according to selfish, dishonest, self-seeking, inconsiderate, resentful, and frightened motives. Motives which, if left unattended, will arouse and engage dangerous and life-threatening levels of lust, pride, anger, envy, greed, sloth, and gluttony. I will turn into a pig. I want everything. This is in turn going to leave me very emotionally sensitive, so everything I hear and see I'm going to take personal. I do not like criticism. I cannot stand to be praised. I do not like to suffer emotionally, and I will not suffer alone. I couple this with a brooding perfectionism, and I live defensively and guarded in fear of being found out. And because of this, I rationalize, minimize, justify, and deny all my actions while casting blame upon you and everyone else in a vigorous attempt to avoid detection. Therefore, I'm quick to anger, slow to virtue, and I judge and criticize everybody and everything I see. Defiance is my outstanding characteristic, and rebellion will dog my every step. So this is who and what I am, and I'm going to base my entire reality on all of these feelings and thoughts. And the only solution for this is steps 1 through 9 in daily work with the disciplines of 10, 11, and 12. Now, all I heard was a click. So if you have a year or less, and you're interested in a relationship, at least be honest with the person, so then they can turn around and make a decision. Now, here's another catch. If the person you're interested in is an AA, here's what you're going to hear from a response. Yeah, but that was with other people. For those of you who haven't been here past couple of weeks, we've spent some time on the first three steps. We took a look at step one, what's wrong with me. They looked at the idea of 33 pages in the big book are identified to answer one question. When I take a drink, do I lose control? Yes or no, experientially. Do I lose control? And the book goes on to say, if that's my experience, it's because I suffer from a phenomenon called craving. And that I'm going to have that till the day I die, so that the only solution is I can never safely drink alcohol in any form at all. Which leads me to another reason I'm powerless over alcohol, and that is sober mentally. I have a mind that will take me back to alcohol, and on my own power, there's nothing I can do about that. That means that I've lost the power of choice and drink sober on my power. For those of you, how many of you have been in and out of AA relapse? Raise your hands. Well, I made this point. I strongly suspect that some of you, after a period of sobriety that drank again, thought you were involved in the choice to drink again. And my experience is that you were not. And if you do not understand this, you're going to die of your alcoholism. See, if I could just sober up and you could separate me from alcohol and I couldn't drink again, that meant I had power over alcohol and I wouldn't be an Alcoholics Anonymous. See? And those pages in the big book, there's 20 pages designed to have me look at that. And the book, in an incredible big book, tells me why I've lost the power of choice and drink sober. Because you can't have choice unless your will is available. And the book says, and it's my experience, there comes times in which my willpower is completely unavailable to me. If my will is unavailable to me, choice is unavailable to me. And it sums it up in the bottom of page 43. Once more, the alcoholic certain times has no effective mental defense against the first time. The dilemma for a guy like me is I don't know what the time looks like. See, I don't know what the time looks like. I don't know what the day looks like. And then the book talks a lot about unmanageability, and we talked about that, the stuff on page 52, restless irritable discontent, trouble in personal relationships, can't control emotional nature, prey to misery and depression, full of fear, feel useless, unhappy, who wouldn't drink? They call them bedevilments. So you get done looking at that first step, and you should come to one conclusion. You need power, which opens us up to the second step. And we took a look at the second step. And the second step talks about, are you willing to believe there's a power greater than yourself? Well, if you've had a first step experience, I think there's only one response to that. You're no longer going to be in what I call the God-debating group of members of AA. See, the only people who want to debate about God in Alcoholics Anonymous, based on my experience, are people who have not had an experience with step one. I'm Norwegian and alcoholic, but I'm not an idiot. I looked at my experience with step one and saw that I needed power, and I was a guy that came into AA somewhere between an atheist and agnostic. But when I saw my need for power, I became a seeker of power and experience with power. Then the second step, we were shown that I'm faced with a self-imposed crisis, lack of power. I need power. See, they're not talking about me and drinking anymore. What they're talking about is me and my lack of power. It's my lack of power that leads to me drinking. It's my lack of power that leads to the manageability of my life. It's the lack of power that sober I go back to a drink again. So there's been a shift, hasn't there? There's been a shift from that first step. All of a sudden, the whole second step is about, do I need power in my life? And I got to make a choice. You got to make a choice in the second step to go for the power. Last choice, by the way, you make through the steps. So I'm faced with this self-imposed crisis, lack of power, and it's my dilemma, and it's self-imposed. It wasn't done to me. And my experience with life showed me that, my experience with alcohol. So I make a choice that God's going to be everything in my life, and I'm told in We Agnostics, my deal is I need to seek God. This power that I so desperately need in We Agnostics, I'm told, it's somewhat paradoxical. I'm told the only place I'll experience the power is deep down within myself. Kind of a new concept to a lot of us who come to AA. I got to experience the power deep down within myself. And it tells me how I'm going to experience the power. I'm going to search fearlessly for this power. So we get down with the second step. We came up to the ABCs, right? A, I'm an alcoholic, cannot manage my own life. Is that my experience? Is that the reality of my life? Drunk or sober? See? I've been talking to you about the steps really from two viewpoints. One is the first time I experienced them. The other is my current experience with them. See, my laurels are what I did yesterday. It has nothing to do with 18 plus years ago. Resting on my laurels. My laurels are what I did yesterday to embrace spiritual living. Right? And see, God couldn't, what if he were sought? How do we seek God? Well, we're going to continue through the rest of the steps. And then we talked about that requirement that I got to meet before I make my third step decision and move through the work. The requirement is that I convince that any life run on self-will cannot and will not work, drunk or sober. That line's important relative to the inventory that I'm going to talk about. That line that any life run on self-will cannot work is very important relative to the third column I'm going to write in my resentment inventory. And then the book spent a page and a half describing to you and I what that looks like in our life. If my arrangements would only stay put. I've always liked standing here talking about inventory because visualization works for me, and the way it works for me is simple. Every morning when you and I are in self-will, we really get up in a podium and everyone in our lives is out here. And what we do that day and the way we go through life is I'm going to arrange it all. He's got to act this way, and she's got to act this way, and the job's got to treat me this way, and mom and dad got to act, and the list goes on and on. And in the book, does another shift. And at this point in time, the book says, selfishness, self-centeredness is the root of my troubles, and they're not talking about alcohol anymore. See? And they talk about when I'm selfish and self-centered, here's how I get to experience life. I go through life being driven. Driven by 100 forms of fear, self-delusion, self-seeking, and self-pity. And if you look up the word driven, when you're being driven, there is no choice. See, I was a long time sober before I saw this. Save some of you some time. Sober, just take a look at the choices, quote, you thought you made in the last year and ask yourself this question. Did I really have a choice when I did that? Or in fact, am I being driven by something that has more power than what I can bring to bear against? My experience is yes. And it goes on to say that what happens to me when I'm living my life like that is that ultimately when I'm driven by that, that people are going to retaliate against me, column one. They're going, I'm going to get angry, column two. I'm going to be hurt, column three. But what we're going to find is I made decisions in the past which later placed me in a position to be hurt. And then it says something else in our book. It says, so therefore all my troubles are my own making. You don't think they meant all of our troubles, do you? See, we don't like that. Why don't we like that? Because that means I got to take complete responsibility for my life, doesn't it? Every phase of my life, how I feel, where I live, where I work, who's in my life, who's not in my life, my bank account, you name it, I've got to take responsibility for that, and I don't like that. See? Because what I've done for a lot of my life is the same thing you've all done, is, and sometimes we're awake to this and sometimes we weren't, is I remained a victim, and I didn't want to take any responsibility for my life. It's a lot easier to say things like, you make me feel, isn't it? Think about that a minute. Think what you're saying. You make me feel. You're telling the universe, well, depending on how you act will determine how I feel, see? And then we talked about last week, above everything, I got to get rid of this selfishness or it's going to kill me, and that is what is wrong with me. You see, it's not about step one. It's not about a craving of the body, obsession of the mind, or internal spirituality. It's about this selfishness. And the book goes on and in masterfully detail says to me, let me explain the dilemma that you are now up against, young man. The dilemma is there's nothing you can do about your selfishness because your self-will can't defeat your self-will. You have to have God's help. Whoa. And it promises me before I make my third step decision that with God's help, I can be entirely rid of self, which is where selfishness comes from. So then I get to make my decision, which is on the bottom of 62, which is from here on out, what I'm willing to do based on being convinced of the ABCs, based on meeting the requirement of the third step, based on seeing the root of my trouble, based on knowing there's nothing I can do about my self-will and my selfishness, knowing that's what's going to kill me, that's what's going to take me back to a drink, then I'm going to make that decision, which is God is going to direct my life and I'm the actor. And God's the principal, I'm the agent, God's the father, I'm the child. And that's this relationship that I get to have with this power. And then we looked at the idea of the third step promises. And you look at the idea of the third step prayer. And then you finish that prayer, and that prayer does not have an amen behind it. My experience is the amen is behind the seven-step prayer. 3 through 7 are a package deal, if you will, based on my experience. And now we get some general instructions on resentment inventory. I'm going to read a few things. And then I just wrote some current inventory I'm going to share with you all to show you how I write inventory. By the way, I want to throw this out for your consideration. For those of you who have been sober for a while, every action I take or do not take in my life is predicated on my belief systems. And in my first 10 years in Alcoholics Anonymous, here is my belief system about steps 4 through 9 in inventory. I had done 2 fairly thorough inventories in my first 10 years. I really had done them in my first 5 years. And I heard in these rooms over and over again that you do an inventory once, maybe twice, live in 10, 11, 12. And I bought that. At 10 years, I almost committed suicide behind an incredible depression, which in hindsight, let me tell you what brought about that depression. I had gone almost 5 years without writing inventory. I had bought this belief system that I could be entirely rid of self with 2 inventories in my first 10 years. And let me tell you what was going on that brought about the depression. What was going on within me was a rage. You know what that rage was? Life wasn't going the way Mark thought it should. And it turned into depression, and I almost committed suicide. I tell you this in hindsight, and those of you who have been sober for a while, if you have not written inventory, the thing I would really have you consider, I would really have you consider writing inventory. I would beg of you to do that. You don't have to have my experience. There's another group in town I go to quite regularly. It's where my sponsor goes. And a member of that group with 12 years sobriety just blew his brains out. Same man I talked to about 6 months ago, and I said to him what I'm saying to some of you that got some time. The last time he wrote inventory was 3 years in this program, 9 years. If you think you can be rid of self by writing 1 or 2 4 steps, my experience is that is a delusional thought. So I share that with you because I almost died behind that belief system. Since then, of course, I come at things completely different. So I will throw that out for your consideration if you have some time away from a drink. I would beg of you to consider going back and reviewing those first 3 steps and going back in and writing inventory so you don't have my experience. You don't have the experience of that man at 12 years. And so the big book's going to talk to us then, and it gives some specific instructions about this inventory. It uses words we don't like, launched, vigorous, stuff like that. And it goes on to tell me that my third step decision, although it's vital and crucial, that decision will not have permanent effect. See, I don't know about the rest of you. I'm in this deal for permanent effect. Permanent effect, what does that mean? It means I don't have to drink ever again, one day at a time. I'm in this for permanent effect. I can't tell you how many people I've worked with dip steps, 1, 2, 3, drink, 1, 2, 3, drink, 1, 2, 3, drink. It's real easy to see why it's 1, 2, 3, drink. In the third step, it's the third step in which I find out what's wrong with me, my selfishness. That only dies in 4 through 9. You see? In 4 through 9. And it goes on to talk about, I need to face and be rid of the things in me which have been blocking me from God, from this power I desperately need. That's the only reason you and I write inventory, right? I want to be rid of self So I've got to write about the things that lie within me that have me blocked from the power I so desperately need. And then the book on page 64 does something that is even more amazing. My liquor, my drinking, is but a symptom. It's but a symptom. A symptom of what? A symptom of what we've already looked at. My selfishness. My selfishness. That is my problem. If that doesn't die, I will drink again and or be sober and miserable. That's my experience. So I got to get down to causes and conditions, my second and third column. So it talks about this personal inventory. I'm going to search out the flaws in my makeup. You notice how the book keeps looking at me? It's not. These are flaws in my makeup which cause my failure. You see? I don't like the tack they're taking with me because they're going to keep coming, putting the spotlight right back here. And they talk about how self, my selfishness manifests itself. And we're going to write three inventories. And all a resentment inventory is a manifestation of my selfishness. And all a fear inventory is a manifestation of my selfishness. And we're going to write a sex inventory. And that inventory is a manifestation of my selfishness. These are three tools, if you will, that are a part of getting rid of self with God's aid. See? And the book goes on to say, resentment is the number one offender. That's an interesting statement. Resentments destroy more alcoholics than anything else. See, that's why the book said, above everything, I got to get rid of my selfishness. That's why our book says, resentments kills more alcoholics than anything else, because resentments are manifestation of my selfishness. I know better than God how the world's supposed to work, how you're supposed to act, how you're supposed to behave, blah, 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 blah. That's why resentments kill more alcoholics than anything else. Because resentments are a manifestation of selfishness. If the selfishness doesn't die, the resentment remains intact. I'm blocked from the sunlight of the Spirit. I create what's called an internal spiritual malady. That is a very uncomfortable feeling. And there comes a day at certain times, I don't know when I get taken to a strange mental blank spot, and my mind, to save me, says, a little drinky poo would be a nice thing. And at that point in time, because I'm not in fit spiritual condition, I will drink. And there's nothing I can do to do that. So I got to get clear on why I'm writing resentment inventory. And it talks about at this point in time then that I, not only have I been mentally ill, I've been spiritually sick. And then I get both a promise and a warning. Here's what it is. When the spiritual malady is overcome, I straighten out mentally and physically. That's the promise. But what's the warning? If the spiritual malady is not overcome, I won't straighten out mentally. Meaning the obsession to drink won't get removed. Now I get specific instructions. I put them on paper. It talks about I'm going to make a list of people, institutions, and principles, column one. I'm going to write why I'm angry in column two. Then I'm going to write a third column, and they show that to you in the big book. I want to take a piece of inventory I wrote. Show you how I write inventory. This is not how I wrote inventory when I initially started. Initially, when I got to my third column, I did what the book said. All I could do is, let's say column one was she left me. We've all got a she left me, right? Self-esteem. I felt hurt. Ambition. I wanted her to stay, you know. Security. I needed her to stay to be okay, you know. And sex relations. All women will leave me. And, you know, just that. That was how the first couple were, which is why not much happened. Because let me explain something to you. I don't write resentment inventory because I'm coming from a place of low self-esteem. I've got just a little bit too much going on. That's my experience with it. It's in my third column, where my third and fourth column, where I'm going to experience what I call the truth. It's in my third and fourth column where I'm going to see where I'm playing God, where I'm self-will run riot, if you will. So, this is a piece of inventory. I want to paint a little scenario. This inventory was given to me 5 minutes before I gave my talk here the first time. Okay? I tell you how much God loves me. There's a bunch of things I'm practicing this year, right? Spiritual practices. Here's one of them. Don't take anything personal. Because if you take anything personal, it's about your selfishness. All right? So about when I came over here to do the first one, about 5 minutes before I talk, I was handed this letter. We'll just put John Doe, column one, right? Now, when I write the second column, I do a couple things. One is I'm very, very specific. Two is I write truthfully and I write bullets. So here's why I'm resentful of John Doe. On January the 2nd, 2001, he said, one, that I am a blatant and consistent violator of the traditions. Two, that I have caused large problems with an Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, as I read this, I want you to keep in mind, I was given this information 5 minutes before I came up and shared with you, all right? Three, that I have no regard for the traditions. Four, check this out, I am disgracing the Glasshouse Group by being allowed to speak here. Five, the taper is pimping what I say and what I say is not AA. Six, I'm a virus in AA, and he's going to rid this area of this virus, however he has to do that. We got some inventory going here, right? Seven, this John Doe lied, said other people asked him to attend my talks to be a governor, AA police. The last piece of information, I was run out of South Texas, right? Now, I got to tell you something. I've had a lot of experiences, but I haven't stopped being a human being. I got this material 5 minutes before I came up here. Now, I got to tell you a little bit about my mind and what happens. One of the voices in my mind I call the brat, right? And let me tell you why I call him the brat. So I'm up here and I'm waiting and I'm being introduced. And the brat, first of all, he's always very serious, right? And here's what he says to me. He says, you know, Mark, he said, anybody who would say that kind of stuff is also capable of shooting someone in a public setting. Have a good night, Mark. So I'm up here giving this talk on my first night. And in between the talk, I got the brat chatting. Right? Now you know how Martin Luther King felt. There's a guy making rapid movements in the back. Watch out. I tell you what, you got to laugh. Now, so that's my second column, right? Okay. And again, I want you all just a moment of empathy. How would you have liked to gotten that and then come up and talk to a packed house, right? Well, I tell you what, you better have God in your life if you got that kind of stuff going on. Here's my third column. Here's how I write today. Self-esteem. Self-esteem is how I see or feel about myself, right? Here's how it rolls out. And when I write inventory, I pray, and whatever comes off my pen is whatever comes off my pen. Self-esteem. I'm a loyal member of AA. I follow the traditions of AA. I'm an honest, direct man, not a wolf in sheep's clothing. I'm a step worker. I'm a spiritual man. I contribute to AA. I'm not a liar. I'm Rambo. I need to kill him. See? Now, I got a little conflict going on here, folks. I'm a spiritual man who forgives everybody, and I'm Rambo, and I want to kill him. We drink over this stuff. This, right? This is just self-esteem. I haven't got to the rest. Pride. No one should be exposed to these vicious lies about me. Ambition. This is what I want, right? Remember, there's a line in the big book about my third column. It says, in this state. It's talking about a state of being in which I'm wrapped up in my ego, my self-will. In this state, the wrongdoing of others fancy real has the power to kill. Here's what I want. I want payback. I want a retraction. I want amends made to me. I want this SOB to work the steps. Security. I need others to think well of me to be okay. Ooh, am I in trouble? How about this? I need others to be direct and talk to me if they have problems with me to be okay. Personal relations. That's same sex. Check this out. Real men work out their differences and talk to each other. They don't run around like jackals in the night. That's my third column, right? Now, once you're done writing the third column, the big book brings about a shift in consciousness, see? Because all my third column showed me there is where I'm self-will run riot and where I'm playing God. So what the shift in consciousness is, as I move into the fourth column, is this. It says, I know I need to go back to this list. For the list, my first three columns holds the entire key to my future. That's another interesting point. That's another sentence that we don't talk much about in AA, and I do not understand that. Let me read it again so you all hear this. This list holds the key to my entire future. I think that's important stuff, right? And here's what it goes on to say. I'm going to look at this from a whole different angle. I'm going to begin to start to see the world and its people, column one, really dominate me, column two. In that state, third column, the wrongdoing of others has the power to kill me. See, I'm fighting for my life. When you are bound to your ego, when you are ego-bound, when you are in the self, and this kind of stuff happens, you are fighting for your life. This is the tragedy of the ego. This is why probably less than 10% of us ever get sober and die sober, because of this kind of stuff that we're up against that we can't beat on our own power. Now, the book gives me a tool before I begin to write my fourth column. Here's the tool. I need to realize the people, column one, who wrong me, column two, are perhaps spiritually sick. Let me stress the word perhaps. And it goes on to say that though I do not like their symptoms, column two, and the way they disturb me, column three, they like me are sick too. So I stop here. And I do what I call the realization. And here's what it is. I look at what I wrote in the second column and I ask myself this question. Have you ever done to anybody what you wrote in the second column? And let me tell you something. There isn't a man or woman in this room that hasn't done everything that I wrote in that second column, including me, more than once. Wow. See? Everything I wrote in that second column I have done. I have spread emotional poison. I have slandered people that I've never even met. Right? I've had people tell me bits and pieces, and I take embellish. Everything I wrote in that second column I have done, and every one of you has too. Why is it important to see this? Because you've got to get moved to the fourth column. That's why. Because earlier on, the book said, my resentments are both futile and fatal. You know why they're futile? I can't do anything about what another human being does or what they think of me. So it's futile. It's fatal because it'll block me from the sunlight of the Spirit. So I see right away that me and John Doe, we're on equal grounds, okay? Ain't nobody better than the other. I've done everything that I've written about. That brings about a shift. Do you follow me? A shift in how I start to look at this thing. So then the book says, well, you need to ask God to help you show these people the same tolerance, pity, and patience you would cheerfully grant a sick friend. Whoa. Think about that. When a person offends, you're going to say, this is a sick man or woman. How can I be helpful to him or her? God save me from being angry, thy will be done. You must avoid any retaliation or argument. Why? You wouldn't treat sick people that way. Wow. See, I've done enough work with inventory that here's what I've come to understand. A lot of my life I've been asleep, driven by self-will, dreaming I'm awake. So have a lot of you. I've never known a human being on the planet, in my experience, that got up one day and intentionally went out to harm me. And I never did that, and neither did you. And this is what the book's trying to get me to see. Mark, you're sitting here getting upset at someone who's asleep, dreaming they're awake, being driven. Just like you. Wow. Wow, isn't that interesting? And you're going to be upset with these people. See? And then it says, why don't we disregard this person entirely, Mark, and start to ask yourself a question. Where are you at with this? Where are you selfish, self-seeking, dishonest, or afraid? So, self-centered. Everything is always about me and how I look. Others should always agree with me. Want others to like me so I look good and feel good. See? Dishonest. That this individual's perception has anything to do with my reality. And the biggest thing, fear, how this will make me look to other people, because after all, I am my image. See? That's how I write inventory today. I've become a free man in this process, you see. A free man. Hasn't always been that way. Couldn't see with the clarity that I've seen today, but that's how I write a four-column resentment inventory. I stay very current. By that I'm talking about tonight before I go to bed, I'll do an evening review and review this day. But I don't stop my human experience, so when stuff crops up, I do just what I did with this. I write about it. Plus, I resubmit to steps 1 through 9, a minimum of one time a year. And I've never had any problems coming up with some inventory. I just haven't. And some of you might relate. I did have a period of time in AA in which I knew I was destined to be a spiritual mystic. I wound up with spiritual hemorrhoids. It just didn't work. I was given a set of tools to get rid of resentments, and I practiced those set of tools. You finish that inventory, and it takes you into the fear inventory. And I don't know if you can relate to this, but my book talks about that fear touches every aspect of my life, the very fabric of my being. shot through with fear. And unbeknownst to me, for all my years drinking and a lot of my years sober, the more of self that's intact, the more I'm going to be fear-bound. The reason you're fear-bound is very simple. When self's intact, you're getting your sense of identity from outside yourself. And if your sense of identity is coming out there, look what you are always trying to control or manage. And that determines how you feel, how you view life, and how you go through the day. How could you not be in fear all the time? The fabric of your being is interwoven with fear. And it talks about, as a result of that, fear is going to set in motion trains of circumstances, and what's going to happen, it's going to bring you misfortune you felt you didn't deserve. Earlier on, the big book said that in all situations, you and I make decisions in the past based on self, which later places us in the position to be hurt. They're going to tell you and I that once again. See, fear-based decisions coupled with fear-based action only lead to more fear. That's my experience. And the book tells me that again. And of course, once again, I get a look inward. Don't I set the ball rolling? So it talks about what I do. I review my fears thoroughly. I put those on paper, even though I have no resentment. Why do I have fears? So I do. I've done many different kinds of fear inventories. I put the fear in column one. Column two, I write, why do I have the fear? Lately, I've been doing some other stuff with it. The book talks about I have fears because self-reliance fails me. So I like to write something else. I like to write, how has self-reliance failed me around this fear? And then the big book has told you and I that you and I got to quit playing God. So I like to write one other thing. How am I playing God behind this fear? And what I always seem to find out every time I do that is the truth is I don't trust God, which is why I'm afraid. That's why I'm afraid. These are some things that I think are absolutely incredible. It says, I'm now going to go through life on a different basis. I'm going to trust and rely on God. I'm going to trust this infinite God rather than my finite selves. I'm in the world to play the role God assigns. Just to the extent that I do as I think God would have me and rely on Him, will He enable me to match calamity with serenity? And then to me, one of the most powerful paragraphs in this whole book, I will never apologize to anyone for depending upon my Creator. Dependence on my Creator is the way of strength. Faith means courage. All men and women of faith have courage. They trust their God. That's the definition of courage. Do you trust God? See, it's easy to talk about that when your external world looks a certain way. How about when it doesn't? See? How about when someone you love dies? How about when you get some crippling disease? How about when you lose a job? How about when there's no money? You see? You trust God then? See? Do you trust God then? I never apologize for God. Now pay attention to this line. Instead, I let God demonstrate through me what God can do. I didn't understand this for years in Alcoholics Anonymous. If you and I do this work, we become a channel. God demonstrates through us what God can do. Think about that. Don't miss that. Don't miss what it's like to let God demonstrate through you what God can do. Do you think I can stand up here or would even want to in front of a group of five people, let alone this many, and talk with any sense of clarity about anything I talked about? Absolutely not. Not only that, would I even want to? No. 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 See? Tell you something. My first 10 years in AA, I was not willing to die the death of self, and I went insane. I wound up in that nut house. And in that nut house, I'll tell you what, I call it, there's two deaths in AA you got to go through. One is around alcohol, and I'll tell you there's another. Are you willing to die the death of self? And sitting in that nut house, 10 years sober, I couldn't live with myself, my false sense of self anymore. And I said, yeah, I'll die. I'm willing to die the death of self. And I started a journey to do that. And then in 1994, because I got to tell you something about me. I was born and raised on a farm in Iowa. I wasn't even around people. I was about 20 years old. People scare me. See? And if any of you think in my wildest dreams that I ever wanted to be a speaker in AA, you are wrong. I tell you something. This is what I want. I'd like to sit in about the middle row, sponsor one or two guys, come to my little home group, go to my job, have a white picket fence, right? That's what I want. healthy. But I was willing to die the death of self, and I made a decision to turn my will and life over to the care of God, and He has a whole other plan. See? I tell people this. The only people in who would ever want to be a speaker in AA are people who are not speakers in AA. This isn't like going to church where they're open and receptive. This is the most judgmental group of human beings on the planet Earth. You understand what I'm saying? I remember when this started to happen in 94, and I said, no, no, I want nothing to do with this, right? Because I had a few other pals that were doing that, and they got attacked all the time. I mean, it was unbelievable. No, God, no. I want nothing to do with that, right? Here I am. See? But I can't do that. The point I'm trying to make is I let God demonstrate through me what He can do. You know, my day starts at 5 a.m. I have had a full day. I got home at 6 o'clock. I was fried. I said, God, you're going to have to be there. I don't even have the strength to get in my car. I get it, you know, and I just felt myself being moved. I'm in my car. And the way I get spiritual, I listen to a little music by Creed at Warp 10, because my God loves rock and roll. By the time I hit that front door, I had enough juice coming out of me to light this place up. See, God demonstrates through me what He can do. I wouldn't want any of you to miss that. To know God at a cellular level, to know His love, to know His power. Our deal is just do the work to be a channel, to know that. To know that, see? To feel the love of God within you at a level that you will weep for joy. That's what this program is about. Oh, just don't drink and go to... No. I'm talking power. Put your hand in a light socket, jump 20 feet straight up. That kind of stuff, see? Stuff that numbs you to the bone. You know? That's what this program is about. These inventories are vehicles to be an open channel to know God like that. Two or three days ago, driving down the road, sometimes the love of God in my heart almost makes me explode. I start weeping so bad. There's a difference between weeping and crying. And I'm weeping so bad I have to pull off the side of the road because I cannot drive. Because His love is consuming every cell of my body. I wouldn't want any of you not to know what that's like. That only has to happen one time. And you'll stand on that forever. Forever you will stand on that. You know God. You know how much God loves you. And you know He will guide you. And you know He will direct you in spite of yourself. See? In spite of yourself, God will do those things. And these inventories are vehicles so that experience can take place. Who wouldn't want to write inventory? I have a whole nother viewpoint on inventory. I know some of you probably heard in AA that inventory is a very tedious process. It's not tedious if you get clear on what it's about. You follow me? It's about the death of self. It's about knowing God. It's about the power of God in your life. Get excited. Big signs, the power of God. Yeah, right, go! Right? See, that's a whole other attitude about it. See, don't miss this stuff. But now about sex, right? And it goes on to say, we need an overhauling there. I mentioned this before, but I'll do it one more time. I want all of you to be clear on the difference between a tune-up and an overhaul. In case anyone in here is somewhat delusional about this. It means you're going to take the whole engine apart. Examine every part, which means every belief system you have about this. Versus a $29.95 quick lube in and out, I'm okay, how are you? Myself and every alcoholic I've ever worked with, we have some pretty bizarre belief systems in this area when we first come into AA. Talks about we don't want to be the arbiter of anyone's sex conduct. Next sentence, we all have sex problems. You don't think they mean all of us, do you? It's part of the human experience. Now I get instructions on how to write a sex inventory. So you make another list. List of resentments, more list, right? So you make this list again. All your sex inventory is going to reveal to you is a whole nother level of your selfishness. Okay? So I make a list, and now there's a bunch of questions that I have to answer. I take a look at the relationship. What I like to do when I write inventory is I like to write how the relationship began, what happened, and how did it end. Because the book says I need to look at my conduct. And then I answer some questions. In my relationship with this person, what actions of mine were selfish? And I write that out. Dishonest, inconsiderate. Who'd I hurt? When I look under who I hurt, I look around the relationship. What actions of mine arouse jealousy, suspicion, or bitterness? Where am I at fault? What should I have done instead? I get this all down on paper and I look at it. And it talks about trying to shape a sane and sound ideal for my future sex life out of this inventory. I've had to do a lot of work in this area. I've been married and divorced 4 times, engaged 6 times. I know what it's like to be driven. See? Driven. 2 times drinking, 2 times sober. See? Asleep, dreaming, I'm awake. This was something that I discovered finally in 95. To show you this program works, I haven't found it necessary to get married since 95. But early on, I guess somewhere in my first marriage, I began to get a sense of self from a woman. And the end result of that was, for whatever reason, when I was not either in a relationship or married, I felt completely incomplete. Because my sense of self was not coming from the fact that I was a spiritual being. My sense of self was coming out here. And I didn't know that. Finally, through a lot of work and a tremendous amount of pain, some of you can relate to, in 95, a belief system I had went away. And that belief system I had was, I do not need a woman in my life to be okay, nor do I need to get an identity. You see? When I look back, and I don't know, some of you can relate to this. When you're bound up in self, when you've been your ego your whole life, unbeknownst to me, my whole identity came externally. I was a reflection of career, money, car, clothes, body, the woman in my life, where I lived. Unfortunately, none of that has anything to do with who or what I am. But I didn't know that. And when your identity and your entire sense of being is coming out here, you are in trouble. Why? Because in a moment's notice, everything that you're getting your sense of self from could be taken from you or could leave. I almost died behind that stuff. But I wasn't even awake to what was going on with it. And I kept doing this work and I kept writing this inventory and I finally started to get it. I tell men that ask me to work with them, if they're married, I am not the guy you want to work with. And they'll say, why? And I said, every man I work with, his wife asked him for a divorce. I got bad karma in that area, right? But I got to tell you something about this because of my experience. And this is just the truth. There's 3 men I work with. 2 of them are from out of town, 1 here. 1 man married 18 years. His wife came home and said, I want a divorce. He called me, and I did this with all 3 men. It happened within about 2 months. He said, what do I do? I say, you tell her God bless you, go in peace. And he said, are you blankety blank nuts? I said, I tricked him again. I said, just a month ago, you told me you love this woman unconditionally. Has that changed? He said, no. I said, what did she tell you she wanted? Well, she wanted a divorce. Then I said, if you love someone unconditionally as God loves, is there any other response other than God bless you, go in peace? Oh. See, that's what love is. What he found out, he's 2.5 years down the road. He found out it wasn't love at all. He practiced that, by the way. And they wound up having a very, as amicable as it can be when you're going through that. And they didn't have to pay a bunch of attorneys and all that other stuff. And this gentleman had stuff, lots of stuff. And he told me he's 2.5 years down the road. And he said what he came to finally understand is that the love of God If I've got the love of God in my heart for another human being, it has no opposite. So what does that mean? He came to see that almost most of that relationship, and it's true of everyone I've had, had very little to do with love, but had a lot to do with what I call ego-addictive, needy, clingy. Because the love of God has no opposite. If you're in a relationship with somebody and there's love and hate, I ask you to consider it's not love. That is ego-bound. See? My deal with all of you today, with everybody in my life, I love you just as you are. You don't have to change one thing about yourself for me. I love you just as you are. And I don't want you to change anything about yourself. That's love. But if I'm bound up in selfishness, I've got a list of things you need to change in order for me to be okay. You follow? See, that's not love. It's not love. Powerful things happen to you if you write these inventories. Very powerful things happen. Talk about the fifth step a little bit. Big Book says that the fifth step is life and death. Just so you think I'm not kidding. Page 75. The person you're doing this fifth step with should realize you're engaged upon a life and death errand. My experience is that's the death of ego, the death of self, and the life of your spirit. Your awakened spirit. Who I do fifth steps with is very, very important. I do fifth steps with men who understand and approve what I'm driving at, who understand my life is on the line. And you are not there to make me feel good. You're there to help me save my life. And that's who I do fifth steps with. I like to meditate 10, 15 minutes prior to reading, and then I begin to read. When I listen to fifth steps, I am very actively involved in that fifth step process. I don't just sit and listen. If you want to get experience in fifth steps, give a lot of them and listen to a lot of them. That's how you get experience. There was a time where, some of you have probably done this, 12 hours, 18, 24, 2.5. One guy showed up with a stack of books like this. Unbelievable stuff. I don't do that anymore because I've listened to hundreds and hundreds of fifth steps. And in hindsight, when I listen to a fifth step, what the book's really asking me to do is find out the exact nature of the defects. Well, you can have 100 names in column one, but ultimately you can probably work with 20 names. And you're going to see the same defects create the same scenario over and over again. I'm not going to sit there for 18 hours anymore because it's not necessary. So who I do fifth steps with has always been very important. The other thing I would throw out for your consideration, the Big Book says if you belong to a religious denomination, you might consider going to a person of, I've done 3 fifth steps with men of the cloth. That's a whole other experience. It was a wonderful experience all 3 times. If you've never done a fifth step with a man in the cloth, then the most you have is an opinion on that, right? But then spiritual life's not a theory. I've got to live it. So you might consider that. It was a whole other experience. I didn't expect the priest to understand what I was driving at, but I still had an incredible experience behind that. Because I think most alcoholics like me, see, I don't ever have to worry about anyone else being hard on me because I'm hard on me, harder than any of you ever thought of. And I begin to understand somewhere in the middle that that's a whole other way of playing God. And those experiences helped me to understand that. So I've done a lot of fifth step. I want to read what I call the fifth step promises, which to me are some of the most powerful in the whole book. Once you and I have taken this step, I've done this with fifth step, withholding nothing, I can be delighted. I can look the world in the eye. I can be alone at perfect peace and ease. Wow. My fears will fall from me. I will begin to feel the nearness of my Creator. I may have had certain spiritual beliefs, but now I begin to have the spiritual experience. The feeling the drink problem has disappeared will often come strongly. I feel I'm on the broad highway walking hand in hand with the spirit of the universe. Who wouldn't get excited about that experience? See? Those of you that haven't written inventory, I hope after tonight you are excited about writing inventory. Because you know why you're writing it, and you listen to these promises. It will happen for you. I guarantee it. This book guarantees it. Anyone in this room who's done this knows this. Who wouldn't want these promises, right? I tell people this. You know, somebody comes at you with, I don't know how many different ways I've seen of writing inventory over the years, 2, 3, 500. I don't know. I just know this. The method laid out in the big book offers me a set of promises which I have experienced every single time. I don't need to go somewhere else to find another means of writing inventory. I write the way the big book does it, and I get to experience these incredible promises. See, in the second step, you commence spiritual growth. After your fifth step, you begin to have the spiritual experience. By the time you get to the tenth step, you've entered the world of the Spirit. What does that mean? The reason you have these incredible promises after you do a fifth step is because in the process of the fifth step, you begin to experience what you really are. You are a spiritual being having the human experience. Everything your inventory is who you're not. There's a line when you, after you finish a fifth step and go home and spend an hour in review, there's a line in there I did not understand for the longest time. Here's what it is. I've read this inventory. I've done this fifth step. I go home. I set a timer for an hour. This is what the book says. There's spiritual virtue and fallen instructions, right? And I begin to go through this list of questions, and here's one of the lines. I thank God from the bottom of my heart. I know God better. Well, you read all this inventory to someone else. How can you know God better? Because the reason you wrote inventory was to face and be rid of that which has you blocked from God. And because of the work in 4 and 5, a whole bunch of things that had you blocked from God got removed, which is why you know God better. See? So I spend an hour in review. I look at the first 5 steps. Did I omit anything? And I review those and I sit with those. And it asks some incredible questions. Is the work solid so far? My work in the first 5 steps. Are the stones properly in place? The second step, the big book says, is your cornerstone. The third step is the keystone. If you don't know that, that's an insane question, isn't it? Right? Have you, any of you ever wondered, the stone's in place? You see, if you don't understand the second step's the cornerstone and the third step's the keystone, that sentence doesn't make any sense to you, does it? Have I skipped on the cement put into the foundation? Do I know what's wrong with me? And the solution, have I tried to make mortar without sand? And once I'm done with that hour, if I can answer these questions to my satisfaction, I then look at the sixth step. Talks about willingness. The next question is only a question that alcoholics would ask. No other group of people. Check this sentence out. Am I now ready to let God remove from me all the things I've admitted are objectionable? Think about that. You write all this inventory, you do a fifth step, you got this long list of defects. Pride, greed, lust, sloth, envy, gluttony, anger, rage. I got to think about whether I want God to remove these or not. I amazing question. The next question is a question of faith. Can he now take them all, every one? There's a lot of different tools I've used for the sixth step at times. I will tell you the tool that I have found to be the most beneficial and brought about the greatest experiences. In the sixth step, I'm trying to identify character defects that my ego uses to operate in the world. And the best tool I personally have ever found for that are the sacraments of penance. You're going to get a hold of those. You go to a Catholic church. Don't ask Catholics. They don't know. What they do is they take the 7 deadly sins, which are talked about in the 12 and 12, and they elaborate on those at a level that I have never, ever seen before. And the very first time that I utilized that as a tool, I had read a fifth step. I went home. I spent the hour in review. And I pulled out, it's 6 pages. And I begin to go through that. And having just read this inventory, here's what I did. They would identify, I'll read a couple, show you how I use this tool. Because it's a tool, that's all it is. For example, they talk about pride. And having just read an inventory, what I said to myself, am I guilty or not guilty of doing this? Pride. Putting self in the place of God as the center and objective of my life. Guilty. Refusal to recognize my status as a creature dependent on God for my existence and placed by Him in a specific relationship to the rest of His creation. Guilty. And I keep going through this. See? Let me read about anger. Check this out for any of you who ever have anger about. Anger, open rebellion against God or my fellow creatures. Guilty. Anger's sole purpose and desire is to eliminate any obstacle to myself seeking to retaliate against any threat to my security, to avenge any insult or injury to my person. Guilty. Guilty. And I go through this thing, and I get done, and there's 7 pages of stuff, and the only thing I haven't done is commit murder in deed. I had in thought. And here was the experience I had with this tool, which is why I'm sharing this tool with you. It's somewhere in the middle of this experience, I begin to understand, and this came my way when I was 14 years sober, 13 years sober. I literally begin to cry in the middle of that experience, and I'll tell you why. I love God more than anything. And at 13 years sober, I fall so short, it is absolutely incredible. Not because I want to, because that's part of my human experience. And I saw that if I do that, you do that, none of us are doing that intentionally, and I saw how much I need God in my life. I did not experience the 6th step from a place of, I'm a horrible person. I experienced the 6th step simply from a place of, I am a creature dependent on God, and if this is the best I can do, I need God. Right? What an experience. Changed me forever in terms of how I viewed myself and how I viewed you. We truly all are, on a daily basis, given this thing our best shot. The other experience I've had with the 6th step, I don't know, quite frankly, if any defects ever been removed from me. I'm beginning to think more and more what's really happened. In the doctor's opinion, I was told that I would have a psychic change. The carpenter says you'll be known by a renewing of the mind. Quite frankly, I think all that's happened to me as a result of a renewing of my mind, that defect that lies within me and probably will to the day I die, no longer has a firing mechanism. See, that which triggered the defect, self. With God's help, I can be entirely rid of self. Great stuff. God bless you all. See you next week.